Third hour of Darren and Donick on this Thursday afternoon. Looks like the Islanders are honing in on their man. I said half of Canada is reporting it. Really, half of Canada, and we should have asked this to Chris Mason. It's probably pretty quiet up there. They're all down in Dallas. Half of Canada is down in Dallas for the NHL draft that's about to kick off, but it looks like the Islanders are set to hire Barry Trotz as their next head coach. Speaking of drafts, the NBA draft is tonight. And if you're looking for a place to hang out and watch it, the Mainstay, 501 Main Street in East Nashville. Yes. Have you heard of it? Been there? I'm sure you have.
Oh, this is my backyard right here. That's my go-to place.
I know.
I love it.
I've been there. I don't even live in East Nashville. I've been there.
You've been there?
Many times. Excellent. A couple times. Not many times. A couple times.
I think they got some good food. Yeah. They got some games you can play. They got the video games there.
Didn't we do a show there?
We have not done a show there.
Are you sure about that?
You and D-Mace might have done a show there. Okay. I haven't done a show there. I'd love to. Someday, maybe we'll talk about that.
The Grizzlies are hosting a draft party there tonight from 6 until 9 o'clock. So if you're looking for a place to go hang out with Grizzlies fans, right now they possess the fourth pick in the draft. You could go over to the Mainstay. But let's find out from our next guest, Michael Wallace. Grizzlies.com is where you can find his work. Are they going to be picking from the fourth spot? Because everything I see has maybe the Grizzlies with a cart in front of them. They looks like they may be doing some shopping, Michael.
Yeah, there's definitely some shopping going on, and that's something that, you know, covering this team and covering the league, obviously, for the, you know, 15 years prior to coming to Memphis, you know, they've been one of the teams that's always been willing to do business on draft night. You know, if you go back, I saw a stat where 13 of the last 17 draft nights, the Grizzlies have made a draft night trade, including five straight. So that trend looks like it's still possibly likely going to be alive. I don't know how far. I don't think they trade out of the draft. I mean, out of the lottery. I still think they want to stay in the lottery, preferably the top 10 picks. But they are open for business, and we'll see whether they get something they like in the last hours leading up to the draft.
Yeah, I can't imagine them doing that, Michael, because they didn't have a first round pick last year. I mean, how many more? I mean, you can't every year, you know, not have a first round pick, especially when you're talking about the fourth pick. I cannot imagine them them trading out of the first round again.
No, that won't happen. I mean, that's the thing. You're right. Not only last year the Grizzlies didn't have a first-round pick, they likely won't have one next year either because that first-round pick goes to Boston.
Ooh.
So you're not trying to, like, you know, dump, you know, three straight years where you, especially at a stage where, you know, everyone knows Marc Gasol, everyone knows Mike Conley. Those guys are in their 30s now. And, you know, there's been some shortcomings and some failures in the last few times you went into the first round. And, you know, Wade Baldwin, obviously out of Vanderbilt, didn't pan out in Memphis. He was the number 17 overall pick 2 years ago. And a couple years before that, Jordan Adams was a number one first round pick. Neither one of those guys are even on the roster. So at some point, you got to replenish your roster with some frontline first round talent. So if they do trade, it's going to be something like they did exactly 10 years ago. When they swapped, they had the number 5 pick, drafted Kevin Love, swapped him for O.J. Mayo, who was the number 3 pick. Now, granted, you know, Love obviously had the better career, but at the time, you know, O.J. Mayo was one of the highly regarded guys coming into that draft. So if they do something, it'll be something within the lottery, more so than anything outside of the lottery.
I don't want to get you in trouble because you're writing for Grizzlies.com. I get that. But we were actually going through the Grizzlies draft picks,
yeah.
And you kind of touched on them. Since they've been in Memphis, it hasn't gone particularly well for them in the draft. I wonder why. I mean, they've had bad picks.
I'll tell you what, hey, you didn't have to put the disclaimer on there. I can come out and say, yeah, it's stunk. You know what I'm saying? The first round picks have not worked out. I mean, I think that's one of the beautiful things about, you know, what you're seeing in terms of this integration of, you know, traditional media and then teams, you know, hiring guys that have been with, you know, independent sites and independent national media to come and do it. We have to come in with the same kind of integrity and the same kind of credibility. And, you know, I'm not going to sit there and sacrifice that by saying, hey, well, you know, the Grizzlies are okay in the first round. No, they've gotten it wrong. And they've gotten it wrong a couple of times recently here, and they need to trend their way out of that. You know, you look around and only Mike Conley and Jarrell Martin from 4 years ago now are the only first-round picks that are still on this roster from the picks that the Grizzlies have made. So, you know, they have to get it right this year more so than any other year because of what you guys alluded to earlier. They didn't get a first-round pick last year. They probably won't get one next year. You got to cash in on this one right now, and this has to be a big one, whether you take it at four or whether you pare it down and get 7 and 22 from Chicago or 12 and 13 from the Clippers and another player. You have to get this transaction right.
Okay, well, fine. Since you put that disclaimer out there, here goes this question then. I think I would have a better chance of selling my Blockbuster membership card and my VCR before the Grizzlies could unload Chandler Parsons in that contract. What do you think?
Oh, wow. You said Blockbuster, huh? I used to have one of those too, man.
By the way, it doesn't work anymore.
It doesn't. What I can say is this, just from reporting up through last night, I mean, I was up to, I think, 2 in the morning, you know, with texts and phone calls and buzzing and all that. You know, there are some deals right now on the table the Grizzlies are looking at, from everything I understand, that includes Chandler Parsons potentially going out or some other combination of a contract that they would like to unload if possible. So that contract is tough to unload, but teams are trying to get up to number four. And, you know, you have some teams that, you know, all the teams that aren't going to get a Kawhi Leonard or a Paul George or a LeBron James in free agency still have to spend to the floor. They still have to spend to the salary cap floor. So if you're willing to get a top five pick and take on a contract where you're going to have to spend some money anyway just to qualify for league, you know, for you know, to league rules, you can get creative in absorbing a contract like that one. So I'm not saying there are 5 or 6 or 8 teams lining up to do that, but all it takes is one or two, and those one or two have sort of made their way into the Grizzlies' office, and we'll see if they're willing to do that. I don't know if you attach the number four pick to that, though, for just anything, just to unload Chandler. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Michael Wallace is with us, Grizzlies.com. Grizzlies have the fourth pick right now. They'll be going to work tonight in the NBA draft to try to improve their roster. Michael, what happened to Chandler Parsons? He once was pretty good to earn that contract, but it just has not worked out at all in Memphis.
Yeah, it was before that too, and that was the disturbing thing too. He came to Memphis, remember, with back-to-back knee surgeries. You know, it started trending in the wrong direction when he was in Houston, and he sort of had that breakout performance in Houston, playing with that up-tempo offense initially. And, you know, with Dwight Howard and James Harden at that time. And, you know, Chandler was the third wheel. And, I mean, he was, you know, the third best player on, you know, alongside two quality players at that time. And he went to Dallas and had the surgery. Then he had another surgery the following March. And then he had a third surgery after his first year in Memphis. So, and now he's gone back to get some things cleaned up with the other knee. So now you have basically, I think, 4 knee surgeries over 2 knees. And then the blood spinning procedure over in Germany, I believe, this offseason. So it's just once the knees start to go, they really start to go. And Chandler's pushing towards 30 at this point in his career too. So, I mean, he's still a young guy. But the fact of the matter is his body and his knees are aging, and he's just in repetitive rehab, and it just hasn't worked out. So that's one of those contracts that, you know, in hindsight, you know, were there some red flags? Yes, there were. But did you hope that you can rehab them and get them right? You did. It hadn't worked out necessarily now, and now you're midway through a $94 million contract with $47 million left on it, and you got to figure out the best way to get any kind of production you can out of it.
The Grizzlies appear to be a team, of course, it's a fact. They're not that far removed from having consistent winning teams who are taking their cracks in the playoffs, just haven't been able to go all the way, but you know, we look at guys like Conley and Gasol. Do they want to continue with this nucleus and see what's out there, or is it time to break it down and build it back up? I would imagine that's a tough decision right now.
Yeah, it is, and they've retooled it. You know what I mean? They tried to retool it last year, brought in David Fizdale from Miami, culture change, tried to go in. It didn't work out for a number of different reasons. But within that, some of that chaos and misfortune, you know, Mark had his most productive season. 2 years ago. Mike Conley had his most productive season 2 years. I mean, the season before last as well. Mike got hurt, only played 12 games this past season, and he's missed 109 games over the last three seasons. So injuries have been really, really the problem that has derailed this thing. I do think if you can get those guys healthy, and Mark, you know, Mark was as durable as he's ever been. He's in the best shape of his life at 33 now. He's changed his diet. He's changed his body. You guys have seen sort of the metamorphosis of Mark Gasol physically. So he still feels like he has 3, 4, 5 years to go if he still wants to play, but at least the next two. And, you know, he's still a guy that you can build around. So what you want to do if you're Memphis, maximize those two guys now. They still are in the midst of max contracts themselves. Bring in a veteran or a mid-career guy who can help them with your mid-level exception, sort of the way Tyreke Evans started to last year. And just hope for health, and some of these young guys that you get in the draft can help you as well. And then you're right back in the mix for, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th seed in the West.
All right, Michael, let's say you're the GM, I'm the owner of the Grizzlies, and I tell you, we're staying at 4. You got to pick 4. So give me your draft board, 1, 2, 3, 4.
My draft board, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we did this mock draft, too, at Grind City Media. So if you're listening, man, check out Grizzlies.com, all of our content at Grind City Media. We have a Grizz Draft Central page where everything on every prospect in the top 8, we did detailed videos and detailed breakdowns. So all of that is in there, including 3 different versions of our mock drafts. And my mock is this. Look, Arizona is pretty much locked in on DeAndre Ayton at 1 out of Arizona. I mean, he's in your backyard, so you might as well take him. Your owner is and the Phoenix owner is an Arizona alum and a big-time booster donor. So that seems like a natural fit right there. Number 2, all the recent talk is that Sacramento is moving off of Luka Doncic. I don't believe that. I believe that, you know, Vlade Divac and Pedro Stojakovic have spent a lot of time over there in Europe with the owner, Vivek Radovani, who really love. I know I just butchered his last name, but they love Doncic, and I think they're going to take him. They may get off of that and go Bagley, but I still believe, to me, despite what's been out there nationally, that they're still leaning towards Doncic, and we'll see there. I think Jaren Jackson goes 3rd to Atlanta, but I do think Atlanta's most likely to make the trade. They're likely to set the draft upside down in the lottery at 3. But if they go chalk and just stay with what they've been consistently saying and intimating, Jaren Jackson's 3, which means Marvin Bagley, the 3rd, falls to the Grizzlies at 4. Mm. And that's how my mock draft shapes up.
If that happens, is that a really good fit, Bagley?
Bomba the center going 5 to 9.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So if you put Bagley alongside of Gasol and you have Conley, is that a good fit? Can he jump right in there and be force first year?
Yes. No question about it. I think if that's the case, I think he'll be in position to be rookie of the year because what he does well is score the ball. And what the Grizzlies desperately need is somebody at the 3 and the 4 who can score the ball. Offensively, they rank near at the bottom of the league in pace and in offense, and Bagley gives you instant, you know, 20 and 10. I mean, he's not going to replicate his numbers at Duke right off the bat in the NBA, but he certainly can be a 15 to 18 point per game scorer who can shoot from the 3-point range, be interchangeable offensively with Marc Gasol, who can step out himself. And even his shortcomings and his defensive deficiencies can be, you know, sort of masked when he's playing alongside of Jermichael Green and a Marc Gasol, two guys that are great system defenders themselves as veterans. So I think, you know, this team right now, as currently constructed, is built perfectly to accentuate Marvin Bagley III's offensive game.
Good stuff. Really appreciate the visit. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it as well.
All right, that is Michael Wallace. Grizzlies.com is where you can find his work. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that. But right now, I want to talk to all the men out there listening. I've been telling you for years now by my friends over at Cool Springs MD. They've been helping men, and there's a lot of men out there that are starting to seek help for hormone deficiencies and imbalances. And Dr. Jeffrey Lodge, who is the board-certified physician, his wife Daphne, the registered nurse, along with their experienced staff, give men the treatments required to improve their quality of life. Cool Springs MD services have already helped many men in Brentwood and Nashville and here in Middle Tennessee, all the surrounding areas, improve their immune systems, energy levels, cognitive function, and more. They're there to connect with you. Their medical care required to have a healthy and enriched life. And who doesn't want that? There's no better time to achieve a healthy lifestyle than this summer. By the way, today is the first day of summer. What are you waiting for? Give Cool Springs MD a call. Make that appointment at 615-660-6900. That's 660-6900. Or you can always check out their website, coolspringsmd.com. Bob Kesslin at the bottom of the hour. We'll talk about legendary Vols voice John Ward passing away yesterday. Predators will release their full schedule later today. We found out yesterday they're going to start off their season. First two games up in New York, Rangers and Islanders. And ironically, we talked about this yesterday. Would they be going up against the Islanders and their head coach, Barry Trotz? Well, it seems like all signs are pointing toward, yes, the second game of the season will be against the Islanders and Barry Trotz. And the Predators will come home October 9th for Calgary, the Flames. So we'll know the full schedule later today. About 3-4 hours from now, we will learn of the full schedule. But the NBA draft is tonight. The NHL draft will kick off tomorrow in Dallas. The Predators do not have currently a pick in the first two rounds. Their first pick will be in the third round. So we just had the discussion with Michael Walls. A very candid conversation about the Grizzlies with the fourth pick. And I thought you asked a good question of, they do have to at least privately be discussing, are we just going to need to blow this thing up and start over, or do you just keep building around Conley and Gasol?
When Conley is in there, you can win some games. The problem is, are you just trying to get back to what he talked about, retooling to finish 6th, 7th, or 8th, and be the first round opponent of the Rockets or the Warriors or one of those teams, or if the Lakers were to retool, you know what I'm saying? Like you could have a solid team, and that's what they've had a lot of years in Memphis, but they have rarely had a team, maybe at the best of this era, they had a team that could get to a conference final.
Well, they did.
And that's what happened, right? The best team that they ever had got to the conference final.
Yeah.
And you still, they did well to do that, right? They had to pull an upset. So what's best case scenario for this group? That's what they have to ask. Now, that was intriguing to me. If Bagley joins them, If he can mesh with Gasol, is that all of a sudden a huge upgrade? And does that have free agents saying, hey, if I join that group, now we got a really good team? That's what I guess.
Would you rather have Jaren Jackson, Bagley, or Bamba?
You know, I'm not an NBA scout. I love Bagley, though. To me, Bagley is.
I'd take him.
I just can't see how he's not a force.
I don't know how he would be available at 4. That would surprise me, personally.
So, well, he won't. He's going to Sacramento.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
So you didn't buy Michael's mock draft there?
They have been wishful thinking.
I mean, that's just one man's opinion. He's well-connected, knows more than I do. Just everything I've heard, and I was watching ESPN specials last night, it just seems that he's going to Sacramento. I mean, he was having an interview with Sage Steele on SportsCenter last night, basically talking about how he's a good fit in Sacramento because there's nothing to do there, and he can just focus on basketball.
Well, it was interesting what Michael said about their front office, because obviously you do have that European flavor, mm-hmm. and so who knows? Maybe they have fallen in love with Luka.
Well, they're saying the same
Luka
thing.
Luka is the mystery, right?
Well, with Luka Doncic, I'm pretty sure one of his coaches from overseas is with the Suns. So people were talking about he's going to go with the Suns. Well, the owner is an Arizona alum. So
yeah, they're going.
There's two connections where, the coach is on the staff. Coach Luka Doncic overseas. But also the guy who owns the team is an Arizona alum and spends a ton of money at the University of Arizona. So it just makes sense that DeAndre Ayton would go there.
So how good is Doncic? That's really the question.
Well, apparently he's 19.
He's 19 and he's broken basically every record there is to break.
He was the MVP of the EuroLeague, and guys at that age just don't get that kind of run. Yeah.
Was it Real Madrid?
Real Madrid, yeah, their basketball team.
He's shattered.
It's intriguing.
He's 6'8", so he's kind of in that weird Although that's kind of where, I guess, the game is. We've talked about this.
Yes. Ben Simmons.
Yeah, I mean, he's 6'8". He's 19. He's been tearing it up since...
Can shoot the lights out of the ball, apparently.
They said 16, that he was already drawing attention. He was already playing with kids or people way older and basically professionally at 16. So he's been on everybody's radar for years. I don't know. I mean, you know, sometimes we've heard of these European players that seem like, oh my gosh, and then they get over here and it just doesn't translate for whatever reason.
But had you really, you know, there's other guys that have been generational players like Ginobili or Nowitzki. I mean, you can go down the list. There are a lot of Europeans that we didn't know much about them.
I think they got here in a while for the European players because there's less of them that come over because we're used to watching these kids, these American kids playing college. Well, there's plenty of college players we've watched over the years who've been top picks and have not panned out. The majority of them, really. So when you get that one European superstar who gets drafted in the top five or top ten who you've never seen, but you've heard a lot about, and they don't live up to hype, we kind of make more out of it than it really would be if they were just an American player that came from the college system.
Well, I'll say this. When I watch all the highlights and the footage of him, he doesn't look soft, that's for sure. He seems like he's fiery and very, very competitive, which you need, right? Because, I mean, that's another thing. It's not just basketball. It's been that tag in other sports where European players come over and they're a little bit soft. And, you know, they get that tag. Some would say unfairly, but they have been tagged that before. He does not look like he fits into that category.
Not sure how you can be soft when you've been playing with grown men since you were a teenager.
Yeah, I know. And it shows.
Kids, like the Bagleys and Aitons of the world, I mean, they've been out there playing with guys their own age basically their entire life. Yeah. This guy's been playing with people in their 30s.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out tonight. Another thing that will be interesting is where does Trae Young go? Because I think he is one of those, right? We always have that one guy. It's like the Baker Mayfield in football this year. There's always that one guy where you have no clue where they could go. Baker Mayfield, we were wondering, is he a first-round pick? I don't know. No, I wouldn't touch that guy in the first round. And then you see what happens. What? Trae Young, where is he? Is he a top 10? I mean, he's going to go first round. But does he translate to the next level? A lot of people say, heck yeah.
Well, what were you?
Other people were like,
Well, what were you thinking about Steph Curry when he came out of college? Right now, Steph Curry had a remarkable run in the NCAA tournament at Davidson, which had him sort of in the headlines. But while he was making that run, where you had to have the same question. Does this translate
but
to the NBA?
And he carried his team. Trae Young did not.
Well,
yes,
the thing with Steph, that was his sophomore year of college back when he, you know, they went to the Elite Eight and lost to Kansas. It was the next year after Jason Richards, the point guard, who led the nation assist that year, he was gone. So that's when Steph transitioned to a point guard because they knew he was going to be kind of undersized to be a shooting guard, also like back in that day's NBA and also today's NBA. So, no, I don't think anyone anticipated him being as good as he is now. I mean, people knew he would shoot, but no one was sure how great of a facilitator and how great of a point guard he'd be. And he had the ankle stuff early on in his career.
Which has still been haunting him a little bit.
Never in my life. Cause, I went to their camp growing up in Charlotte. Like, I've been watching Steph play, I mean, for basically my entire life. Never in my life did I think he'd be as good as he is. It's astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, if there was a do-over, that draft board would look a whole lot different.
Well, there's a lot of do-overs in Steph's basketball career. Like Seth Greenberg not giving him a scholarship at Virginia Tech basically got him fired.
Yeah.
I have wondered a lot in watching Trae Young because – remember what he did in his first 10 or 12 games, the non-conference games. Which
set the college basketball world on fire.
But as teams started to figure out how to guard them, they didn't really have they couldn't really solve it. They were able to get to the tournament, but that's about it. I have wondered, what does Trae Young look like on a team where he's not the focal point of the defense? Everything was tracked to try to keep him from getting open shots. What would it be like if he actually got some open looks? Because he has amazing range.
Well, that's the thing. His teammates, and we can even talk about Steph Curry's teammates at Davidson were better than Trae Young's teammates this past year at Oklahoma. When you're in the NBA, because there's a lot of times where he's setting guys up who have wide open three-pointers and they're missing them. Now, unless you're LeBron playing with the Cavs and Jeff Green, for most teams, you're going to be able to find guys who can actually hit those open shots. So when you're able to be as great a passer as he is, and he's already a great shooter, he's got to put on more weight, and he's going to have to be – he turns the ball over a lot, so he's got to be better with his ball handling and decision-making. He's going to – I feel like he would be able to flourish in the NBA in the next coming years. Now, he's not going to step into the league next year at 19 and just, you know, score 20 points a game. That's not going to happen. But four or five – because you're projecting these guys out down to the future. Back when he's 23, 24 years old, he should be one of the premier point guards in the league.
I do think he's a pretty special shooter. Remember, he didn't have any doubt. Wasn't it Dan Patrick recently, and he said, who's the best shooter? He said, I think I'm as good a shooter as anybody,
yeah,
basically.
By the way, the mocks I've been looking at have him going to Cleveland with the eighth pick. Mm. Wouldn't that be interesting? Mm. We will come back. We started off the hour going west in the state. We'll go east. We'll go to Knoxville. We'll talk to Vols voice Bob Kessling. Of course, the unfortunate news we got yesterday, or a lot of you may have learned this morning, the passing of John Ward. We do that next on Darren and Donick, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Becker on Darren and Donick on this Thursday afternoon. Lot of you heard of the news last night. Some of you unfortunately had to wake up to the news, but sad news coming in East Tennessee. And look, if you've been here more than a minute, you basically have a John Ward story. And Willie and I talked about our John Ward stories earlier, but there's nobody that somebody that could tell the John Ward stories way better than us, and that is Vols voice Bob Kessling. He's on the line with us. Bob, how you doing? Thanks for doing this.
I'm doing great. Wasn't Willie Donick involved in a block charge game in a Vanderbilt, Tennessee game that Ward was not too pleased with?
Look,
you got the call. Do you remember that?
Bob, this is the story Willie is trying to tell me and the listening audience, that when he started doing stuff for Vanderbilt shortly after his career, that John Ward claims that he remembers everything about Willie's career at Vanderbilt. That's the story he's trying to tell. I said, the problem is you didn't tell that he called you Bruce Elder and you didn't correct him.
How about that?
Bob, I'm sure there was more than one block charge game between Tennessee and Vanderbilt, but the one I remember my freshman year was at Thompson Bowling Arena. It was Wade Houston's first year and Eddie Fogler's first year at Vanderbilt. And we did the play where you set the screen along the baseline where you're taking the ball out of bounds, the length of the court. And you try to have the guy run into the guy setting the screen for the guy taking it out of bounds. And it worked really well. One of the Tennessee players bowled over our guy, and they didn't call it. They just let it go. Our coach exploded. So I don't think that's the call you were thinking about. There was one with Phil Cox, right? A little bit before my time.
That was it.
That's the one everybody still talks about. Yeah, I don't think John was happy about that one.
He's never gotten over that. He never got over that. So anyway, that was it. It was Phil Cox, wasn't you? I apologize. It put you in a bad light.
I would have loved to have been there. I'm getting compared to Phil Cox. He scored about 2,000 more points
than
I did.
Yet again, Willie's not correcting people on these examples. Hey, Bob.
I got you.
You know, we've been at this for a long time. You've been at it for a long time, and we all have people, especially early on in our career, right, that have affected us and shaped us and molded us, and we've taken things from observations and what have you. I'm going to turn things over to you because, what did John Ward mean to you and what you've been at it now for a long time?
Well, I would not be in the position I'm in now without John. I mean, my relationship started with him back when I was at UT, back when I was going to school. I had played football for a year and figured out that was not going to work, and so I found something else. But I was able to befriend the director of photography for UT, who also did all the coaches' shows, because he was coming out and filming some of the pitchers for the old Knoxville Sox baseball team, which I got a summer job out there. So he told me they needed a film editor on the Bill Battle show. And they said, didn't get paid much money. You couldn't go to the games. You had to cut the flash frames out of the film during the game, so then John Ward and Ernie would be able to come in after the game and start putting together the Bill Battle Show. I said, that was fine. I think I was paid $15 a game, and I think John said I was overpaid for what I was doing. And so that's how I met him. And then I got a job at a local radio station, WIBK. WIBK got the rights to the game. John needed a spotter. And so about 1977 or 78, I started spotting for him. And I did that until 1992. I sat next to him every single game, and I watched him work, and I was smart enough to keep my mouth shut and my eyes open, ears open, and listened and watched. And it was sitting like, it was like if you were a painter sitting next to Picasso or something like that, just learning how to do it and you know, how to carry yourself and how to treat people and all those type things. And John was a master at all of that. So I really, and he gave me opportunities. You know, he started letting me do pregame stuff and halftime stuff and postgame interviews and all those type things that really helped me grow as a broadcaster. And I had several opportunities to go to some small schools to do football play-by-play. But, you know, I thought I would learn more sitting next to John Ward than I would be out there in the wilderness thrashing around myself. And that was a smart decision. But he taught me basically everything I know about what I'm doing now, and I'm really indebted to him.
Mm. You're right about that. We've all been fortunate enough to be around a lot of legendary people, famous people, and certainly I've said over the years, sometimes be careful what you wish for. You don't really want to meet them. It's better that you just think of them from afar. Well, that certainly wasn't the case with John Ward. Anybody who had any interaction with him, he made you feel like, you know, you were special. He listened to you. He cared. And that was, he was just the opposite example. It would be a guy you absolutely want your kids or your family or people you were with, your friends, to have interaction with John Ward, because he would make you feel like, you know, he cared what you had to say.
You know, and he wasn't, although, you know, his style on the air was very authoritative, and you knew, I mean, he's larger than life and all those type things. But when he wasn't on the air, he would be the guy standing in the corner. I mean, he didn't want to be in the spotlight. He wasn't the you know, the toast of the party. He wasn't the guy in the middle of the ring cracking jokes. I mean, he was kind of a shy guy, and he'd stay off to the side. One thing that I always admired about him, and at first people thought this was kind of egotistical, because a lot of times he'd have a briefcase or a satchel and he carried around with him, and he had 8x10 autographed, pictures in it. I mean, who does that? Who carries around autographed pictures of themselves? But he did it because when little kids would come up to him or somebody wanted his autograph and maybe all they had was a napkin or a scrap of paper, he didn't want them to go away with, because they'll throw that away. They don't want to make it home. But if somebody really wanted an autograph that bad, he said, let me give you something that you can take home as a souvenir. And he'd pull out an 8x10, and he'd sign it for him. I don't know anybody else that ever does that. But John did it. And there's so many people today that are reflecting how John did that for him, and they still have those pictures in their rooms or at their office and all those type things. He was special that way. He was an advertising guy. That's where he made his money. He did the broadcasting as a hobby, basically, is what he said. But he was in advertising, so he knew how to market. He knew how to package stuff. He got his law degree, and he never practiced law, but it helped him with the command of the language, and it helped him organize, and it helped him think things through. And so when he go to do a broadcast, he had that marketing skill of packaging the game, but he also had that legal background where he's getting ready, like he was going in to be Perry Mason or something like that. You know, be a big time, like he was in trying a murder case or something like that. I mean, he was so prepared. He'd have a little clipboard, and he might have 30 or 40 typed written pages of notes, anecdotes, things about players and coaches, the series, all those type things, which I'm sure he memorized, but he had it in front of him, and he'd occasionally flip through it. He maybe used 30% of it. You know, Willie, you know, yeah. You've got all that information when you're doing a hockey game. Maybe you use half of it, but you better have it in case you need it. And that's kind of the way John looked at it. You better know where the information is, because it might come up, and you better have done your research and done your homework.
it's so interesting you talk about those 8x10s because I had a diehard Kentucky fan on my freshman hall. Had grown up in Versailles, Kentucky, right outside of Lexington, and he was all in on the Cats, but he loved John Ward, and he sent away for one of those pictures. He had it on his dorm room. It was the only thing that was not Kentucky blue in his room, I think. We had a hard enough time for him rooting for the Commodores, and he went to Vanderbilt. I used to give him a hard time. But I think that's an interesting thing, Bob, about John Ward is anybody who listened to him, even if they weren't a Tennessee fan, you couldn't help but be entertained by his presentation of a game. So he transcended even the diehard Tennessee fans.
Yeah, he did. You know, and he wasn't – you knew he was rooting for Tennessee, but he wasn't an outright homer. You know, sometimes outright homers turn you off. And, oh, I don't want to listen to that guy. He's so pro-Tennessee, I can't stand – he wasn't like that. I mean, you knew he was rooting for Tennessee. But he really, especially basketball, he enjoyed calling basketball games. He enjoyed – there's nothing more that he enjoyed – better than a great basketball game. And yeah, he wanted Tennessee to win, but he just enjoyed the drama, setting the game up, all those type things. He just enjoyed, again, marketing and packaging the game. And the better the game was, the better John was.
Bob Kessling is with us. He's the current voice of the Vols, and he succeeded John Ward, who passed away, of course, last night. We're giving tribute to one of the legendary broadcasters in John Ward. And Bob, you've done such a tremendous job in following in his footsteps. But as you know, and any broadcaster knows, you could never imitate and do what he did. So you had to come up with your own style. But as you said, you learned so much from him. How did you try to take some of the things that he taught you, but not go on to go behind the microphone and try to recreate what he did? Because nobody could do that.
Now, you know, Willie, it's interesting you bring that up. It was 92, and I was getting ready to go leave the Vol Network and go to Jefferson Pilot. And John called me, and he tried to get me to up my pay from, I think he was paying me $100 a game to like $110 if I'd stay on and keep spotting for him and not take the Jefferson Pilot gig. He was laughing. But he always called me Kiesling. He never called me by my real name. He always called me Kiesling. And so I got this call one time, and he'd go, Kiesling, Warped. He called himself Warped. John Warped. I said, John, how you doing? He said, congratulations on this Jefferson Pilot deal. He said, now listen. He said, don't do all this phony hocus-pocus crap that I do when I'm doing the broadcast, all those stupid phrases and stuff I use. We don't need another John Ward. We need a new Bob Kessling. And they hung up. but he was right. You know, that's what he said. Don't try and be me. You know, go out and do the broadcast the way you need to do it. And, you know, I was so blessed because long about that time, you know, Lindsey Nelson was still around. And so I got to work, with John Ward and got to know Lindsey Nelson. He used to, when he retired from the Giants, there was Cherokee Bluff up above campus, and that's where he moved when he came back from San Francisco. And I'd get to go talk to Lindsey. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Being able to associate with Lindsey Nelson and John Ward. And then when we moved my mom up here and we moved her into an assisted living facility, George Mooney was in the assisted living facility. And so I had a great relationship with Lindsey and George Mooney and John Ward. I mean, what a history of the Vol Network. Mooney, when he was living in the retirement home, they would do baseball bingo. And so what they would do, they get all the little old ladies out there, and they had the bean bags. You throw the bean bags, and it'd tell you whether you got a single or whatever. And they bring the Bearden High School baseball team over to play against the little old ladies in the rest home. And George Mooney would do the play-by-play of the baseball game, the beanbag baseball game. And the little old ladies kicked Bearden's butt every single, they couldn't be, those little old ladies were in their walkers and stuff. They're motoring down to second base on a double, and Mooney's going crazy. It was one of the greatest things ever. So I've really been blessed to just get a great education, understand the Vol Network, the roots of the Vol Network, because Lindsey started it. He told me all about that. And then George Mooney talked about all those great teams with the General and Bowden Wyatt, and then got to work with John. I've just been really, really blessed.
And last thing, Bob, he had passionate, you know, obviously he was passionate about what he did, but he also was passionate about other things outside of the booth, right? He loved being in the yard. He loved golf. I mean, there were other interests.
Yeah. He lived on the first fairway on Fox 10 Country Club. And he had the lot next to his condemned because it had some drainage issues. So he bought that lot at a discount price. We basically got two lots for the price of one. But he went all over the country looking for rhododendrons and azaleas and exotic flowers and fountains and all kinds of stuff. And, I mean, his yard was on the dogwood trails. And, I mean, it was unbelievable. And so one year they were going to flip-flop the sides. They were going to make that the 10th fairway instead of the first fairway. Well, John didn't like that. And so he kind of out of character started doing door-to-door polling and getting petitions and had town hall meetings to get them to stop it so they wouldn't flip-flop the sides. And it worked. His law degree finally paid off. And so I saw him after they turned it down, and I said, John, you know, I don't have a dog in the fight. I'm not good enough to play at Fox Den. I said, but why do you care? You could go out. You could be on number seven. You could walk out your back door and play a round of golf, and then come back in. It doesn't matter what hole you're on. He said, no, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. If they flip-flop those sides, that first tee, the 10th tee, that means people are hitting scuffed-up balls in my yard. I don't want those balls in my yard. I want balls that won't even hit one time. I want brand-new Pro V1s. I don't want those old beat-up balls in my yard. Are you kidding me?
Oh, my.
And so he would have a wicker basket full of golf balls, Pro V1s that have been hit one time, and you'd go over to see him, and he'd hand you a brown paper bag, and he said, take some golf balls as a party gift. And so you get a bag of brand-new golf balls, and then you'd leave, and that would be the deal. So he was always doing something. I mean, he was so, as we mentioned, so larger than life when he was on the air. But when he wasn't on the air, he just had a great sense of humor. And some of the best times I had were those Friday nights having dinner with Bill Anderson and John Ward before games, and listening to those guys tell stories and laugh. And it was, a lot of times we travel together. If we're going to Nashville or to Kentucky, we'd all travel, just drive up there and listen to those stories between those guys going up. It was magic. It was just a lot of fun.
Wow. Mic drop. That was a great way to end it. Bob, I know a lot of people have asked you to talk today about this. We really appreciate you joining us. Thanks for doing this.
Well, I appreciate you guys, too. Thanks for calling. Talk to you soon, I hope.
All right. That is Bob Kessling. He is the voice of the Vols, and wow, that was fantastic.
That was good stuff.
We will come back and wrap up the third hour next.
The Volunteers come racing onto the field. What time is it? You know. It's football time in Tennessee.
The kick is in the air, and the kick this time is... No, sir, please. No, sir, please. Final score, Tennessee 20, Florida 17. Pandemonium reigns.
This will be Manning. Back to throw. Across the middle. Pass complete. What did he do? All he did was score. Touchdown on play number one.
Give him six. That's all. Touchdown, Tennessee!
That was way too short. I wish there was a lot more of that. That just feels big. Right? I mean, it just feels like a place you want to be. You're listening to the broadcast, you're like, I'm glad I'm listening to this, but man, I so want to be there. You know, we've talked about that with broadcasters where it just feels bigger when they're, you know, you're here, there,
yeah.
You hear them
oh,
doing
yeah.
the game. It just feels bigger. I think John Ward was really good at selling. And those games were huge, but he did a great job of selling just the magnitude.
And more people probably have memories, if you're Tennessee fans, of him calling big football games. You heard Peyton Manning in there. He was so good at calling basketball games, too. Yeah. As Bob pointed out there, he just loved it. This the style. And I always wondered where he came up with that style. I don't know that he learned it from anybody. He just had it, I think. And Bob Kessling has done a remarkable job of filling those shoes and doing a solid job, and he's great in his own right because he didn't fall into the trap. That's a great story he told about what John Ward basically told him.
When he left.
Just be yourself.
Yep.
You know, you have to.
Well, he said, don't be another John Ward. Be, you know, the new Bob Kessling.
Right. But so many people, and George Plaster might be the best that I've heard that can imitate John Ward, because from that era, you know, especially when there were less games on TV, towards the end of John Ward's career, especially football, Tennessee was on TV almost every game. There was a time where if you had three or four games on TV, that was a lot.
But right? 70s and 80s, not so much.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Like, Tennessee occasionally did get on a national TV, but, you know, outside of Oklahoma and Ohio State and Michigan, you just, you know, the games that you saw with Keith Jackson doing, there just weren't a whole lot of games on TV. So the radio guy was even bigger. But there were so many people that they wanted to hear John Ward. They would do the TV thing. They would do the turn the volume down and put the radio on to hear John Ward. But I just think that the biggest compliment that I could pay is for non-Tennessee fans. They enjoyed listening to him. As Bob pointed out, he was enthusiastic for Tennessee, but he was not what I would call a homer. There's a lot of people that have their own definition of what a homer is. I think enthusiasm for the team you're calling is a must, or else your own fans are not going to really enjoy you and embrace you. But you can have that enthusiasm without being a homer.
Well, Larry Munson was a legendary voice, but he was a homer. I mean, like, you knew exactly.
Right. And so the other
what
teams.
What broadcast he was doing.
So let's throw him as an example, because he is a once-in-a-lifetime announcer, too, in his own right. Extremely, extremely unique. But if you weren't rooting, if you were listening as the other team's fan, it may not have been as enjoyable to listen to Larry Munson.
No. It wouldn't have been. I mean, let's
I didn't get that feeling as much with John Ward, because he was so good.
Yeah.
And he was not a homer. He was enthusiastic, but he was so fun to listen to.
I think Bob was kind of painting this picture. He knew where the homer line was, and he knew where not to go, where it was going too far, where you went over the homer line, right? He would always walk it up there, but then never go. You know, Larry would blow right back. In fact, he would scrape it off and say, I don't care about the line.
Right, right.
But that was what, I mean, you know, for Georgia fans, that, you know, they couldn't get enough. I mean, they lapped it up. Like it was a big bowl of milk.
Right,
I mean,
and if you were neutral, like if you were just listening to Georgia against, if you're a Kentucky fan and you're listening to Georgia against Tennessee, you might enjoy listening to Larry Munson. He was that good.
Yeah.
And interesting.
But if you're at the game or you're watching that game and you're the opposition's fans, yeah. I don't think you would want to hear the call.
Right.
Right?
Because he was right into our guys. It was all we, all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Hardcore.
Hardcore. But he was also a legendary voice in the SEC. Man, I miss some of the voices we had in this conference, right?
Whew. Yeah.
Some great ones. We'll come back fourth and final hour at around 1:15. We'll talk to Sounds play-by-play man Jeff Hem. He got delivered great news earlier this week and even better news today. We'll tell you about what we're talking about. Final hour coming up next on 102.5 The Game.